Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. Here are some of the news items I'll be covering. In the war in Israel, Gaza's future, ceasefire talks, and famine. India's spy agency engages in assassinations, and China's cities are sinking. First, three developments in the Israel war. Gaza's future. Does the Israeli government have a post-war plan? The New York Times reports that one idea is circulating, quote, "Behind the scenes, senior officials in Prime Minister Netanyahu's office have been weighing an expansive plan for post-war Gaza, in which Israel would offer to share oversight of the territory with an alliance of Arab countries, including Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, as well as the United States," according to three Israeli officials and five people who have discussed the plan with members of the Israeli government. According to that proposal, Israel would do so in exchange for normalized relations between itself and Saudi Arabia. Actually, that plan may have its origins in Washington, where the idea of a multinational force with Arab states contributing emerged a year or so ago. But huge obstacles to the plan remain, starting with the far-right people around Netanyahu, who are looking at resettling Gaza and the West Bank with Israelis. The Arab states are by no means on board. They demand steps toward a Palestinian state. Finally, the plan apparently would include keeping the Israeli Defense Forces as an occupying force in Gaza for some time, another surefire way to eliminate support from the Arab states. The second major development is that this plan is overshadowed by Israel's incursion in Rafah. The idea that we will halt the war, referring to an invasion of Rafah, before achieving all of its goals is out of the question, Netanyahu told relatives of hostages. Comments like that, which Netanyahu has made many times before, seem designed with two aims in mind: either put the kibosh on negotiations with Hamas, or force Hamas to accept Israel's ceasefire proposals. But Netanyahu has rejected Hamas's ceasefire proposals because he says Hamas's call for a withdrawal of all troops from Gaza and an end to the war is unacceptable. Such proposals, he said, would leave Hamas intact and open the way to another attack in the future. He also said this on television: "Surrendering to the demands of Hamas would be a terrible defeat for the state of Israel. Hamas has obliged by firing rockets from inside Rafah. Israel has already ordered 100,000 people to leave the city. Once again, U.S. officials, including President Biden, have warned Israel against a Rafah invasion, citing the likelihood of huge civilian casualties. But now, the Israeli Defense Forces are there, in force." The third development, probably with a view to forestalling an attack on Rafah, Hamas on Monday said it had accepted a Qatar-Egypt ceasefire proposal. The deputy chief of Hamas in Qatar said that each stage of the agreement is 42 days long. The first stage is an Israeli-Palestinian prisoner swap, which includes Israeli civilians. The second stage is a complete Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. Predictably, Netanyahu rejected the proposal out of hand, and his cabinet decided that the operation against Rafah would go forward to, quote, "destroy Hamas's military and governing capabilities and ensure that Gaza does not pose a threat to Israel in the future." In other words, the Netanyahu government still aims at total victory, but Israel did send negotiators to discuss this latest proposal. While both sides debate a ceasefire, we have the other major development. The head of the World Food Program says that northern Gaza is in a full-blown famine. She went on to say, quote, "It's horror. It's so hard to look at, and it's so hard to hear. I'm so hoping that we can get a ceasefire and begin to feed these people, especially in the north, in a much faster fashion," unquote. Her view is in line with other reports. The director of the USAID program has also said famine is imminent in Gaza. And Mercy Corps has just reported, quote, "Half of the population of Gaza, around 1.1 million Palestinians, are facing catastrophic levels of hunger and starvation. The entire population, around 2.2 million, are facing high levels of acute food insecurity," unquote. Israel disputes these claims, arguing that its humanitarian relief is surging. That is true, but at this point in the war, with so much destruction of lives and property, any meaningful relief effort needs to be at a far higher level than currently. India's spy agency engages in assassinations. The world's biggest election, quote-unquote, is coming up in India as Prime Minister Narendra Modi seeks a third term. He'll probably get it, but his government falls well short of being a democracy. Besides its Hindu nationalist ideology that seeks to deny Muslims their fundamental rights, the Indian government spy agency is engaged in plotting the killing of Modi's overseas critics. I've previously reported on a case in Canada that implicated the agency in the death of a Sikh leader. Canada made the first arrests in that case last Friday. Now, a Washington Post investigation has found that the agency ordered the assassination of Sikh activist Gurpatwant Singh Panun, a U.S. citizen residing in New York. The plot was thwarted by U.S. authorities. The Post's investigation, based on extensive interviewing, links the plot to high officials in Modi's government. The audacious attack on a U.S. citizen might seem a reason to cause a rupture in U.S.-India relations. But as one Western security official, as described in the report, explains, the Indians, quote, knew they could get away with it. Another reminder that power politics always trumps human rights. Satellite data reveals sinking risk for China's cities. Most of China's major cities, starting with Beijing and Tianjin, are slowly losing elevation. A study in the journal Science shows that, quote, in 100 years, a quarter of China's urban coastal land could sit below sea level because of a combination of subsidence and sea level rise, unquote. The main causes of subsidence are building construction and pumping of water. Climate change and consequent rising sea levels may combine with subsidence to increase the pressure on cities. Unless China takes remedial action, such as Holland is known for, cities will face cracks in the earth on a major scale, such as happened in Tianjin last year, when thousands of high-rise residents had to be evacuated. In other news, a few more stories on the environment. The personal costs of climate change are huge. The most comprehensive research on what the destruction worldwide caused by global warming will be is $38 trillion by mid-century. Average incomes will fall by about 20%, but that's just an average. The impact of environmental destruction will be roughly double in developing countries what it will be in the United States and Europe. South Asia and Africa will be hardest hit because, as one of the authors states, of the impact of climate change on agricultural yields, labor productivity, or infrastructure. The study further finds that the effects on income will rise dramatically in the second half of this century unless climate change can be halted. Loss of income also affects those least able to afford it and least responsible for it. On the other hand, for the richest citizens, lost income is insignificant, which brings me to another unpublicized piece of news, this one providing another illustration of why the rich stay rich in America. It's the huge gap between rich and poor in the effective tax rate. The 400 richest Americans, the billionaires, now for the first time in U.S. history, have a lower tax rate, 22%, than the working class people, 23%, who constitute half the population of wage earners. The tax rate on the most wealthy has gone steadily downward since 1960, when it was over 50%. In 2000, it was still around 35%. Taxing billionaires is on the Biden agenda this year, but don't hold your breath that any legislation for fair taxation will pass anytime soon. Next, the Rio Grande ecosystem is endangered by the Texas government. Years of efforts to stem immigration from Mexico by clearing riverbanks and in placing barriers have harmed the river environment as well as violated human rights. As one resident of Eagle Pass, a controversial crossing point that the Texas governor, Greg Abbott, has invested heavily in stopping entry, says, quote, I'm genuinely concerned because this slow degradation of the beautiful ecosystem that has existed for thousands of years is all under the false pretext of security. The ecosystem needs to be preserved, taken care of, and respected because it is the only water supply for Texas all the way downriver. He adds, quote, the governor has overstepped his bounds by disregarding federal protections to the ecosystem. He started tearing up islands, bulldozing riverbanks, and placing barriers that have altered the flow of the river and created an incredible amount of erosion. The river will try to defend itself any way that it can, and I'm just speaking up for the river, unquote. Abbott's plan is to quarter as many as 2,300 Texas National Guards at Eagle Pass in defiance of the U.S. government, which is normally responsible for immigration issues. And finally, on the environmental side, California's solar energy problem. The problem arises from having too much of a good thing, excess solar energy in this case. By last count, the Washington Post reports, the state had nearly 47 gigawatts of solar power installed. enough to power 13.9 million homes and provide over a quarter of the Golden State's electricity. That's great, but a good deal of that energy goes unused during spring and summer, when midday temperatures sharply reduce demand for electricity. Thus, quote, in 2022, the state wasted 2.4 million megawatt hours of electricity, 95% of which was solar. That's roughly 1% of the state's overall power generation in a year, or 5% of its solar generation. Last year, the state did that in just the first 8 months, unquote. Wasted energy raises prices and cuts incentives to homeowners to adopt solar, a reversal of what energy planners had anticipated. Other states, such as Nevada and Hawaii, are also confronting the waste issue. Maybe it's a welcome problem, however, if better storage of excess energy can be built and if transmission lines can carry the excess to states where there's a need. Another case of Pegasus spying, this time from Poland, how governments use spyware to track political opponents and critics. The Israeli-made spyware, called Pegasus, broke into the headlines a few years ago when an investigation by a group of journalists revealed that Pegasus, embedded in cell phones and virtually undetectable, was being used by a variety of governments to spy on politicians and journalists. Now, according to a report from the Associated Press, quote, Poland's prosecutor general told the parliament that powerful Pegasus spyware was used against hundreds of people during the former government in Poland, among them elected officials. He said he found the scale of the surveillance shocking and depressing. Over a five-year period, three different government agencies in the increasingly authoritarian government of the Law and Justice Party spied on nearly 600 people. The new government of Prime Minister Donald Tusk launched the investigation into Pegasus that made these findings. The Biden administration, by the way, has banned the use of Pegasus by the federal government. Scientific unfreedom in China. Dr. Zhang Yongzhen, the Chinese virologist who was first to share the COVID genome, was for a time shut out of his lab at Fudan University in Shanghai. He staged a sit-in. The Shanghai Public Health Clinical Center ordered him out. Dr. Zhang's work contributed mightily to development of anti-COVID vaccines. His removal from his lab supposedly was to permit safety renovations, but clearly much more was involved. Speculation is that Zhang's willingness to share his data with virologists outside China put his work at risk. Now, both sides say the dispute has been resolved, and Zhang has returned to his lab. Finally, a few updates. First, from the Solomon Islands, where the pro-China prime minister, who was re-elected to his seat in parliament a few weeks ago, has stepped down. Manasa Sogavare's party failed to win a majority, so his party chose a new leader to seek the prime ministership. But a coalition of opposing parties fell short in seeking to elect a prime minister friendly to the United States. Instead, Jeremiah Manele, the former foreign minister under Sogavare, was elected, ensuring that a China-friendly leadership will continue in the Solomons. And second, tensions in the South China Sea continue to ratchet up. The Philippines has made its 20th formal protest to China over the conduct of heavily armed Chinese Coast Guard vessels operating in the South China Sea. Quote, the Philippines protested the harassment, ramming, swarming, shadowing and blocking, dangerous maneuvers, use of water cannons and other aggressive actions of China Coast Guard and Chinese Marine Militia, said an official statement. The Philippines urged China's boats to leave the waters immediately. These protests are likely to go the way of all previous ones, as Beijing continues to claim territory in the South China Sea that a United Nations court turned aside several years ago. Meanwhile, China is also protesting, this time over the U.S. Army's first ever deployment of the so-called mid-range capability ground-based missile system. It is being deployed to the Philippines and has a range of 1,600 kilometers, which China recognizes as a potential threat to its navy. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertal. Thanks for listening, and take good care.